Manila Chan. You are tuned in to Modus Operandi. A seldom-discussed U.S. base in Syria gets attacked, leaving three U.S. service members dead. Suddenly, American mainstream media attention turns to Syria after a long pause after regime change efforts failed. We'll discuss the rising risks posed to U.S. troops with a fantastic panel straight ahead. All right, let's get into the MO. Tower 22. Nobody had ever heard of it until late January of 2024. That's when a drone struck the living quarters and killed three U.S. service members and injured dozens more. The U.S. was quick to blame Iran, and the media brought voices calling for immediate action and retribution. Iran denies the attacks, and U.S. officials have since softened their language, opting now for Iranian-backed groups who were behind the droning. So just what are U.S. troops doing there in the first place? To discuss it, we'll bring in our expert panel. In studio with me is Michael Maloof. He is a former senior Pentagon policy analyst and has a Rumble channel where you can all go follow him at Official Michael Maloof. And joining us remotely is our friend Jim Jatras. Jim is a former U.S. diplomat and Senate GOP advisor. Gentlemen, so great to have you both. Thanks for joining.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, Mike, I'm going to go over to you first. So it's been reported that the Al-Tanf Air Base has been operational since 2016, which puts it squarely at the setup years in the Obama era. It was supposed to serve as this, you know, kind of geographically perfect location, kind of in this tri-state region that's along the borders of northern Jordan. Obviously, Jordan, a friendly country to the United States. It hits southern Syria and then to the farthest west of Iraq. But there was this little secret outpost called Tower 22. I see you're grinning. Where, unfortunately, through this folly of errors, three U.S. service members were killed recently by drone. Tower 22, not a secret anymore. What can you tell us about Tower 22, and are there others like it across the Middle East? What goes on at places like that?
Well, Tower 22 is actually a logistical support facility, small, located in Jordan to service Al-Tanf, which is in Syria, where we're not invited.
Huh.
Al-Tanf is just inside of Syria, but they're so almost co-located, except by a border. What Tower 22 does is take in drones. It not only provides logistical support, but it has a landing strip for drones and actually provides intel in support of the U.S. mission in Syria,
okay,
which is look for ISIS. So it's remained remote. It's never come under fire before, and that's what led to this calamity. Is that either through the very, very good luck on the part of the Iraqi resistance, or through planning, they staged the missile that hit the base to coincide with a landing of a friendly drone.
Wow.
And as a consequence, it was let in, and they didn't know the difference, which also indicated that because it was small and remote and in a friendly country, it didn't have the sophisticated detection and missile defense systems.
Okay.
That you would have at other facilities.
Are there other Tower 22 types around the Middle East?
There are. When you look at the map of Iran, you have something like over two dozen bases that surround. Someone has joked once, "Who put Iran in the middle of all of our bases?"
You know?
But they're big and small. Some are very significant. Some are attached to the Fifth Fleet out of Bahrain. Others are in Kuwait, Oman, and Saudi Arabia, certainly, and UAE. Qatar.
So they're sprinkled throughout.
All over the place.
Okay.
All over. Plus, in Africa itself, you have small special forces elements which are spread across northern Africa to deal with the spread of ISIS and okay. and groups that align with locals, and so we're talking like over three dozen.
Wow. Okay, that's not an insignificant
no.
number. Jim, I'm going to go over to you. President Obama, who once famously called ISIS junior varsity, he found himself needing this varsity-level response to this apparently not-so-JV threat. So U.S. troops found themselves in Syria back then in his era. ISIS has since been defeated, and in large part due to Russian airstrikes. But the Russians, the difference here is the Russians were invited there by President Bashar al-Assad, unlike the U.S. Now, Congress did not vote to go to war with Syria. Why are U.S. troops still being placed in harm's way, and as many would describe it, as illegally occupying Syrian land? I mean, is there some sort of legal or diplomatic loophole that we all missed?
No, of course not. I mean, let's go over this notion that there's anything like a U.S. Constitution or a U.S. rule of law that governs any of these things, that we've long since left that behind. Look, I think there's a couple of things we need to understand here. First of all, ISIS is just a pretext that for the better part of a third of a century, there's been this obsession in U.S. policymakers with basically occupying the Middle East, first occupy Iraq, and then bring down Syria, bring down Iran, have total American control of the region. The reasons for that are complex, but there's no doubt but that's what we tried to do. And Iraq was the linchpin. Unfortunately, when we invaded Iraq, got rid of Saddam Hussein, was a primary bulwark against Iran, we ended up creating what then the same policymakers were concerned was going to be the Shiite corridor, that Iran was going to have a road to the Mediterranean through a friendly Iraq, a friendly Syria, and then to their friends at Hezbollah. So Al-Tanf is basically where we interdict that corridor. Remember, the major part of the American presence in Syria is in the north, in the Kurdish areas, in the north and east of the country. Al-Tanf in the south is designed to cut off the main road between Iraq and Syria and to close off this corridor that we are largely responsible for creating in the first place. As far as ISIS, let's remember that famous 2012 Defense Intelligence Agency memo that predicted that the result of American policy of supporting these Salafist Sunni terrorist groups in Syria would be the creation of a so-called Salafist emirate in eastern Syria, which turned out to be ISIS. ISIS is a direct consequence of American policy in Syria. And in fact, General Michael Flynn, who was the head of DIA when that memo was written, confirmed later to Al Jazeera that this was not a result of negligence. It was a desired outcome of the policy. You'll notice that for all this talk about ISIS, 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 they don't really attack American interests in the region. They don't attack Israeli interests in the region. ISIS is essentially a boogeyman that allows policymakers to say, oh, we have to stay in Syria, we have to stay in Iraq, because otherwise ISIS, ISIS, ISIS. It's just the local version of, you know, Russia, 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 China, 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 Iran, Iran, Iran. You know, you come up with the suitable threat to justify what you want to do for completely different reasons. And as far as Congress, to the extent to which they're even aware of what's really going on, look, they've long since ceded the aggressive designs of the executive branch to the president. The converse is not true, however. If you have a president like, say, Donald Trump, who says, let's get out of Syria, that's another story. That can't be allowed because, after all, ISIS would take over in the vacuum that we left.
Yeah, absolutely. Now Mike, since we're on the topic of ISIS, as we know, Al-Tanf was established as a result of this so-called ISIS crisis. Mm-hmm. Then soon after, it started getting used to train, lo and behold, anti-Assad militia. What is Al-Tanf still there for? I mean, the regime change operation failed, I guess, back then. I mean, so isn't this just all mission creep?
Well, it is. It has been. And we were not invited there, as Jim has pointed out. And we were invited into Iraq. However, Al-Tanf has now become a very serious point as to why we're even there any longer. ISIS is supposed to have been done away with. Mm-hmm. And frankly, when we went in to deal with ISIS, and Jim's right about the 2012 memo from DIA, I remember when it came out, it basically called it a principality that was being developed initially, and it then became the caliphate.
Right.
Okay. So and that really created, because Flynn brought this out and was right, this really created a problem between Obama personally and Flynn. That's why he was always on the outs afterwards.
He was still active in the military at that time?
Yes, he was the head of DIA, as Jim pointed out. So this, and then his world crumbled after that. But Al Tomf is there to be that crossroads, and we're remaining there under the rubric of trying to deal with ISIS. But you know, what you have today that we didn't have then were these popular mobilization forces of the Shia.
Okay.
And they're all now part of the Iraqi government.
Okay.
And they can easily deal with
uprising
with any ISIS return.
Sure.
Of any kind. So we need to be getting out. There is talk of the Iraqi government asking us once again, pretty please, would you please leave? And we may take them up on it this time.
Wow.
We didn't before because we wanted to remain in Syria to deal with the oil.
Sure.
Where we're making revenue off of it.
Sure.
So the whole idea, we've always supported the Sunnis, and ISIS was Sunni, radical Sunni, but still. And in fact, we use ISIS even to this day as well as the Israelis for our own purposes against one other country, Iran.
I see. All right, we'll hang on to that thought. Coming up next, a lot of hay has been made about, you know, the ballooning DOD budget and sending money overseas to places like Israel and Ukraine. Some other foreign interests, though, fly under the radar. We'll discuss it when we return with our expert panel. Sit tight, the MO will be right back. Welcome back to the MO. I'm Manila Chan. Let's jump straight back in with our expert panel. Michael Maloof here in studio and Jim Jatras joining us remotely. Thank you for sticking around, guys. Jim, I want to go straight to you this time. So with no declaration of war in Syria, Iraq has voted, I think, several times at this point to purge American troops from their land. How does the executive branch, today's executive branch, or the legislative branch of our government continue to justify this ongoing deployment of these troops in these places where we continue to send tons of money as if it were this given part of the annual DOD budget?
Well, being exceptional means never having to say you're sorry. I mean, if we have this inflated view of our role in the world, and there's a consensus for that among the ruling establishment in Washington, whichever party, little things like, oh, the UN Charter, the rule of law, the United States Constitution, things of this sort simply do not mean anything. And, you know, they can talk all they want about what's the authorization for the use of force and how it applies to this or that circumstances. I mean, as I recall, when we first went into Syria, it had something to do with the authorization that was passed after 9/11, which had absolutely nothing to do with anything to do with Syria, but with a straight face, they would cite this. Again, Manila, it's, you know, I think a lot of Americans have this kind of antiquarian view toward how our Constitution applies to the way that affairs are really conducted on behalf of our country, and it just doesn't apply. Once they have a consensus, and the consensus is always in favor of do something, however destructive it might be, it's never in a consensus in favor of we need to get out of these places. The Constitution and the law are quite flexible and really non-existent. And I think it's kind of sad, actually, that many Americans assume that their government behaves in a constitutional and responsible way, and it just doesn't.
Yeah, I think that just about summarizes it all pretty accurately. Now, this question is going to go, I'm going to say, I want to hear from both of you on this. Let's zero in on Iran for a moment. Mike, I'm going to let you take first crack at this. We've heard the likes of John Bolton, Lindsey Graham, and for years before his passing, we heard from John McCain, all rail on Iran, explicitly calling for war with Iran. Do you foresee that happening?
Well, that's going to be a toughie. I tend to doubt it. I tend to doubt it only because that would create such a quagmire for us. And I'm hoping that there might be divine intervention someplace that can avoid that. But the way things are moving, it's almost, I hear Netanyahu constantly trying to egg us into it, and pushing us into it. And basically, Netanyahu is guiding the U.S. policy right now. It has for years. Mm-hmm. And we always look at the Middle East through the prism of Israel anyway, and which is wrong. And unfortunately, if it goes to a higher level of kinetic warfare out there than exists now, the Iranians will follow through. They will attack. Even though we created all these bases for deterrence, deterrence is gone. Our deterrence is gone. Now these bases now become our Achilles heel, because we have all of our personnel exposed, all of our assets. They're all targets.
I see.
They're all targets. So we got to be very careful. And I hear the Lindsey Grahams and the Boltons. They're in a war they don't like. They're neocons.
Sure.
And as a consequence, they want to push American democracy even at the barrel of a gun. And that's what they've been doing. And we saw this with Iraq. We saw it especially with Iraq. When we had troops committed in Afghanistan, and then in 2003 we switched horses all of a sudden, and when I was at DOD this happened, and I recall being told the policy will be we go into Baghdad, we overthrow Saddam Hussein, set up Baghdad as a hub, then to have regime change in Iran, Syria, then Libya, and then Saudi Arabia, all countries at that time which were which were hostile to Israel. And this is what we are living, this is the policy we are still following today.
Jim, what's your read on this? I mean, do you foresee the war hawks in D.C. Having their way and us going to war with Iran?
I tend to agree with Michael that the chances are probably less than 50%, but not as low as I'd like, given the, as Michael says, the fact that Mr. Netanyahu has more influence in Washington than Joe Biden does. And of course, how much does Joe Biden even have on Joe Biden, given his mental state at this point? I think it's one of these. Remember what the husk that passes for Joe Biden said the other day, that these attacks on the Houthis in Yemen have not stopped the attacks on the shipping, but they will continue anyway. So we have this kind of mentality here that if we hit something somewhere, that shows we mean business, but it doesn't actually have the desired effect except to stimulate more pressure on our forces to get out of the region. Let's remember that when Netanyahu spoke to Congress several years ago, he talked about four areas where the Iranians were effectively controlled foreign countries: Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. And you notice those are all the places now that are heating up because of the crisis in Gaza. We have the confrontation with the Houthis. We have the confrontation between the Israelis and the north of Israel with Hezbollah. And then, of course, we have the Shiite militias in Iraq, which, as Michael points out, are officially part of the Iraqi governing structures, their armed forces. And then, of course, we have the Assad government, the legal government of Syria. In each one of these places, as Michael points out, our presence, our liabilities rather than assets. We can't actually do much with these assets that wouldn't instigate even greater blowback and danger to these forces well beyond these three unfortunate people that were killed in that Tower 22. If we had any sense, we'd get out of there, but we don't have any sense. And that's where the real danger comes in. I don't think, despite the Boltons and the Lindsey Grahams and the rest of it, there are that many people in Washington, especially at the Pentagon, who are crazy enough to say, push the button, let's go to Tehran. But you never know when one of these things will spin out of control. More than just three people get killed. Maybe an American warship is sunk or something like that. And then we're off to the races and the thing escalates from there. That's the danger,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And Jim, let me stay with you while you're on the soapbox. We're in an election year, obviously. Nikki Haley is in that camp with Lindsey Graham for war. I'm personally not certain where Trump would fall on this issue. And the current POTUS, Joe Biden's administration, is certainly taking a pretty aggressive posture, I would say, against Iran. What's your read on how this plays out in 2025 after Inauguration Day?
You know, I think it's very hard for me to foresee that we're going to be in essentially this situation in January of 2025. I mean, it's like Trump says, I'll end the Ukraine war in 24 hours. I don't think that war will be going on in January 2025. I could be wrong about both of those. You know, it's hard to read Trump because remember, you know, he always says, I could have stopped this war. I had Iran in a box. I'm big. I'm tough. These things wouldn't have happened on my watch. Well, let's remember, all of this stuff brewed under his watch. We armed Ukraine to the teeth under his watch. We basically threatened everybody in the Middle East to put pressure on Iran under his watch. So the stage was set under his watch, largely for the reasons that we discussed earlier. Trump can give all the orders he wants, and he did when he was president, and nobody followed them anyway. So the idea that he would come in and somehow wave his orange magic wand and make all this go away, I don't think is going to happen, assuming the situation is even more or less what we're talking about now, that he could very well find himself in power. And, you know, and it's the same, you know, set of swamp critters that will really be calling the shots no matter what he thinks he wants to do.
Yeah. Mike, final thoughts on this? I mean, we're really only going to be we're going to do a rematch of 2020 and add in Bobby Kennedy.
Well, I think Trump will probably make it. If he makes it, I see him taking a slightly different approach toward the Middle East for this reason. It would be his last term.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's going to move all of Trump International overseas. He's going to need Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia wants to reestablish the Abraham Accords, and they said if Israel stops the war, they will then and creates a Palestinian state, then they will normalize relations with Israel. It'll get, and he's done everything he can for Israel right now. So now he's got to look out for his golden parachute, as it were, and his family's golden parachute.
Sure.
So I think he's going to look to more toward cuddling up with Saudi Arabia and what they want. I mean, that's just my hunch. I think he can, we just stop funding Ukraine and we begin to pull some of the troops out. And if we're hearing the Europeans already talking about, you know, a post-NATO environment.
Yeah.
They're talking about having a European defense system. Mm-hmm. So we're going to see changes, and I think they're going to be to Trump's liking.
Oh, boy. It's going to be a totally new year, gentlemen, in 2025. Let's wait and see. Jim Jatras, former U.S. diplomat and Senate GOP advisor. Michael Maloof, former Pentagon senior analyst. Be sure to check out his new Rumble channel at Official Michael Maloof. Thank you, gentlemen, both. All right, that is going to do it for this episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy and current affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO.